through the scientific evidences for the God of the Bible and going through the biblical passages that deal with this subject material. Before I get going, though, two brief reports to pertain to the subject matter. I'm going to have my wife Kathy come up here and give you a little report on a phone call the two of us had with Doctors Lynn and...
Carla.
I know Carla.
I get stuck on these names, but I hope no one takes it personally, because once in a while my dad or my mom call, he forgets their names. And I know he knows them, and they know he knows them. You know, it's this name thing. You know, it's that low cholesterol. It's just not there. Anyway, I apologize to those of you who have no idea who Dave and Lynn Carter are, but the rest of you know that Dave and Lynn have been a big part of this class for a long time, and they are getting very well settled in back in Maryland. And they called one evening, this is a few weeks ago, and they were just so delighted to report all the ways in which they could see the hand of God in their move, just the special ways that God worked to provide a place for them, to prepare. They said it's this almost goosebumply feeling of having God prepare the way for them, even in little details like finding a neighborhood where there are some kids that their girls can play with and a great soccer coach for Amanda, who's really gung-ho as a soccer player and who found just an ideal situation there. It took them a little while to find a church that they really felt comfortable with, but not long. When you think how long some people search for a church where they really fit and feel a sense of belonging and are totally, you know, back east. But they have found a church that they dearly love, and they were introducing themselves to the pastor, and apparently when they mentioned, I don't know how they did, I guess they mentioned the church that they came from and that they were part of a Sunday school class, and
they heard of me.
They said, you know, something about Tom, and a pastor was thrilled. And then they happened to mention Hugh Ross, and he scratched his head. It was so funny. This pastor, Dave's words were these. He said, the pastor almost assaulted us. He was so thrilled. He jumped all over him. Go, you know, you are on his mailing list, and I read his books. The wonderful thing about this pastor is he is a pastor by second career. His first career was as a college professor, English. He was an English professor at the university, and he had a heart for his colleagues, all these secularists, the students, the professors, who were Christianity and the church was going right by them. They had it had no impact on their lives, and God just sort of moved him into a new career as a pastor, a new direction in his life as a pastor. So here they are in a church with a pastor whose heart is to reach these secularized people with no church background, no interest in church, and that the church hasn't really touched. And he's looking for creative ways to reach out to them. Of course, he's thrilled to have Dave and Lynn to be part of his congregation, and I guess they have a page on the internet that the church does, and he's talking about getting Hugh to come back there and whatever. It really gave them a thrill. And then in the lab where Lynn works, just some key people have prepared a foundation, have really exposed the staff already to a very honorable and a favorable testimony of Christ-like love. And there have been a lot of crises. A lot of people have had cancer and have had serious health problems. There have been some deaths. And the people in the lab seem to be at a moment in their life of real openness. And Lynn just senses that God has placed her there at this time, in this place, to be a light and to serve him and to learn and, you know, grow. And she's just very, very thrilled. So I wanted to share that with you. And I think we forgot to bring it, but I will bring their email address with me the next time when I'm a little more alert on a Sunday morning. And we'll put it up on the board. And any of you who want to just jot them a little note via email or whatever, that'd be much appreciated. They missed the class. They said, hello, please say hello to everyone and give our love. And I just wanted to share their excitement for what God's doing.
Okay. They're even going to establish one of these video conferencing things in their home. So if we put one here, they can be part of the class. That's the next step. I mean, it's coming, folks. The prices are now down to $250 a station, and it's cheaper than making a phone call. So it means you got to get dressed in the morning, though.
Yeah.
So, well, yesterday afternoon, three of us from the class here, some of you remember Dr. Bob Taylor, and he was at our research biologist think tank meeting yesterday. That was the second time he attended. But Dr. Ralph here, it was his first time attending. So I'm going to have Ralph come up here and just give you his impression of that meeting.
Well, to say it formally, I was totally jazzed. It was a it was a great meeting. It started at 2, and I don't know what time it broke up, but I got home at 6. So it was a wonderful meeting, and there are a fine bunch of guys there. And there are the ego trips that are so prevalent in academia were at a distinct minimum there, and which pleased me greatly, because there's nothing like a bunch of biologists who are all trained in very specialized subfields of subfields and know their own field very well and know virtually nothing of anything else, doing things such as name-dropping by citing articles out of the air and this kind of thing. But there wasn't any of that. Most cooperative bunch of guys. And I sat next to Lynn's former professor at UCR, and Jim Baldwin, and a neater guy you couldn't find. And I think she had a wonderful influence on him. And across the table was Jack Seacrest from UC Irvine, who will probably be doing most of his work at Caltech now, and he's in neural regeneration. And I think he brought us at the end of the meeting down to the cases when we started talking about reviewing different articles in the literature. And the fact of the matter is, everybody sitting there all reads different biological literature. So some of it is easy to come up with items that are of importance. Some of it isn't. And he made the point that I'm trying to make, that we are all in specialized fields of subfields of subfields, and that it gets a little hard. But the thing is, I think we are going to begin turning up the kind of literature that will be helpful to you and to Reasons to Believe. And again, I haven't spent better three and a half hours in a long time. It was a great day, and I thank you for having that going, Hugh.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's wonderful. I mean, I think of where else in the world can you live and have the 50 evangelical research biologists willing to get together. I mean, it's awesome, the kinds of resources that exist here. And we're hoping to be able to do that in every discipline. It'd be good if we had a group for geophysicists and one for mathematicians and so on down the line. And, I was just really encouraged by yesterday's meeting, too. I mean, it's a group that we've been gradually trying to challenge to the idea of getting more involved in Christian apologetics. And I think one of the more encouraging things for me is just to see their love for one another grow. They're getting to know one another and just being encouraged by seeing one another. And so thanks, Ralph, for your report. It's been good. So we have some exciting material in the arena of biology to report about in the next Facts and Faith. I don't know how much my editor is going to allow to slip through, pardon me. Excuse me. We could talk about that, yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing that's got me jazzed up is there's been a new breakthrough in technology in biology, which actually allows biologists to examine biomolecules at the atomic level, where they can actually see the individual atoms. And so for the first time, biologists have the tools to actually look into the complexity of these biomolecules. And because we were talking yesterday just how there's all this complexity in biology, and it's like biologists just kind of see right past it. They don't see it. But now they got the technology to actually look at it. And so we're developing a couple of articles on the beginnings of that kind of technological investigation. And one is a discovery of the world's smallest motor. It's not only the world's smallest motor, it's really the smallest motor that's possible to build. And so to me, that's one testimony of design we see in biology, is that, you know, we have this little motor there, and you really can't make it any smaller. The laws of physics don't permit it to be made any smaller. Yeah, this is a protein inside the cell. And they've been able to, you know, photograph this thing. And what it is, it's only 10 billionths of a meter on one side and 8 billionths by 8 billionths on the other. So it's a very tiny little thing. That's how tiny it is. Only a few atoms across. And this thing has an engine block, it's got a crankshaft, and it's got three pistons. Okay? And the motor turns over at a rate of between half a hertz and 4 hertz. That means between once every 2 seconds and 4 times a second. And this is this beautiful little three-piston engine. So my response is, how can any biologist look at that and say, well, it just kind of happened by these atoms bumping into one another? I've looked at three-piston engines in automobiles, and they don't seem to be the product of iron ore and aluminum ore getting too close to one another. So, but more amazing than that is they actually took on something that was bigger. This isn't the biggest molecule. There are far bigger molecules than the one I'm going to tell you, but this one has a molecular weight of 2 million. That means there's 2 million protons and neutrons that make up this molecule. And you know, anything bigger, they don't quite have the capacity to investigate yet. So this is one of the, you know, medium-sized biomolecules they're looking at. And what this thing is a sophisticated garbage disposal molecule. Yeah, it's a sanitation system. And what happens is smaller proteins come along to the proteins that that are to be trashed. There's a command center in the cell that figures out which proteins need to be trashed. And it sends out these little small guys that go out there. And what they do is they add little bits of protein called ubiquitin to these proteins. And then this big monster molecule comes along and spots this stuff and says, aha, this is something that's supposed to be trashed. And so what it does, the first thing it does is it pulls the molecule into its mouth. And the mouth is designed to untwist the thing, because your typical protein, it's like, I don't know, yeah, if you do climbing or something, you get this 200 feet of rope and let your kids play with it. What does it look like after a while? You know, a big jumbled ball is going to take you hours and hours to untwist and unravel. Well, what this thing does, it takes these molecules, they're designed like that. They're twisted and turned and curled up all in an incredible mess. And what this molecule does is it gets this thing close to its mouth and it carefully unravels this thing, undoes all the knots, all the twists, all the turns, and stretches it out into a line. And now that it's into a line, it's able to gradually pull it inside its guts. It's got a little core there. And once it gets inside the core, there's this little ruler. Okay, it's got a little built-in ruler there. And it actually pulls this protein in like this, measures it out, and when it gets to the right length, it snips it. Okay? And then it sends it out the back end. And it pulls a little bit more in, measures it out, and snips it, and pulls it out the back end. And so coming out the back end are all these little pieces of these little linear proteins. So now they're, you know, manageable lengths. You know, they're untwisted, unfolded, uncurled, and they're cut up to the right length. And then there's another set of proteins that come along, and they're the garbage trucks. They pick up this stuff. Now, not all of it's thrown away. Most of it's recycled. They said, well, you know, we got to build more proteins. So we got this stuff all nicely chopped up, and it recycles it, and it sends it to the factories that build new proteins, and some of it just gets moved out the cell. So it's just like these guys that come to your place and, you know, recycle. They pick it all up and take it away, and stuff that can't be recycled, they take it out to some dumping ground. So
where do you read? Is this in print?
It's all in print. Yeah, it's all published in Nature. Both articles were published in Nature.
Can you buy that over the counter? Do you have to subscribe?
You can buy it over the counter if you've got a fat wallet. So, I mean, I think they charge like $8 an issue. It's incredible. So,
do you know what issue that
particular? Hey, better than that, we can get you a photocopy. So if you want a photocopy, no.
Well,
no, I can't. If I do that, I'm violating copyright.
No, I'll be happy to buy it.
In fact, I think you can even download this stuff. So... if you're at JPL, I'm sure you can get it downloaded. Yeah. Well, it was, you know. Yeah. Every library carries Nature. It's kind of the news science journal out there. But the board of Nature, the editorial board, is almost to a man and a woman, atheists. And it's interesting, the title of this paper, it was called Real Engines of Creation. And then they quoted a verse from Matthew about the lilies, how they neither toil nor spin. And they said, hey folks, we found something that toils and spins. But of course it's not a lily. So, I said, when was the last time I saw a Bible verse in the journal Nature? So... or the word creation, but there it was. Anyway, I think this is an exciting breakthrough, and it's just a matter of time before they document, even more incredible engines. And they're discovering things like proteins that have got springs and torsion bars built into them, just like the suspension system of an automobile. And they got little levers, things like equivalent to what you see in clocks. This is stuff they're seeing for the first time. They've never had the technology to investigate things at that level. They didn't have the resolution to see the springs or the motors or the levers. Now they do. So, and as this guy points out, it's incredible. Nature already invented an oscillating piston engine. And if we had that technology a few hundred years ago, we could have had cars a lot faster. But so, yeah, true. There's other aspects of it as well. Okay, where we were last week, we've been through the first chapter of Genesis, and looked at its scientific accuracy and how it gives us these 14 events of creation, 4 initial conditions. And we now have the scientific knowledge to realize that the Bible gets a perfect score, correctly describes all 14 creation events, as well as the 4 initial conditions, and puts them all in the correct chronological sequence. Now, if you calculate the probability that Moses could have assembled those 18 items in the correct chronological sequence if he's given to them in random order, that alone is a powerful argument that the book cannot be the result of mere human authorship. The human author would have to be divinely inspired to develop that degree of precision. But of course, far more amazing than that is that the descriptions are correct, not just the order, but the descriptions. Yeah, I think a bit of comparison is helpful too. Let's look at the creation account that scores second place. There are actually over 200 different creation accounts in the religions and cultures of the world. And the one that scores second place with respect to the established scientific record is the Enuma Elish of the Babylonians, which gets the score out of 2 out of 13 right. So the Bible gets 18 for 18. The Enuma Elish gets 2 out of 13. And as many Bible scholars have pointed out, there's a reason why the Enuma Elish gets such a high score. The Babylonian culture was closely related to the culture of Abraham. Abraham himself was a Babylonian from the city of Ur, the city of the highest learning of the early Sumerians. And therefore, it's really no surprise that the Enuma Elish has some similarities to the biblical account and gets this fantastically high score of 2 to 13. In fact, in one respect, you could argue that 2 to 13 is a bit too high if all you got is human authorship going. But given the relationship with Abraham, that would account for that. But the fact that the Bible does so much better, describes things in far more detail, and is perfect in its description and order, ranks as one of the most powerful proofs that we have that the Bible indeed is the error-free Word of God, not just for faith and practice, but for science, history, any discipline. And that's really the doctrine of biblical inerrancy we're promoting here. The Bible is inerrant, not just for faith and practice, but for science and history. And one critique I would have of those is say it's only accurate for faith and practice. It's very difficult to put a line between faith and practice and science and history. In fact, one point we've been making here in the class, you really cannot come up with a significant statement from science that doesn't have theological implication. Neither is there any significant theological statement you can develop in the Bible that doesn't have scientific implication. So often here in America, scholars tend to treat science and theology as mutually exclusive, two circles that never overlap. And even in seminaries, I see professors of theology who will admit to a little bit of overlap, but the overlap is like that. You know, maybe 5% overlaps. What we're trying to argue for is that the overlap is complete. It's 100%. And there's really nothing in theology that doesn't have scientific implication. Neither is there anything in science that doesn't have theological implication. In fact, at a conference I was attending with scientists, I said, can you name me any statement of science? And they came up with lots of examples. But it's just that because of their lack of a theological background and training, they didn't realize. You know, like one says, well, how about the fact that carbon is composed of 12 nucleons? And I said, that's got theological implications. Mm-hmm. If you make it anything else, you don't get life. And so it's part of the whole design paradigm. So, you know, in that context, it's you really can't find anything within science. Likewise in theology. But I think what we saw yesterday, we're dealing with people who are so specialized at the highest levels of scholarship that they don't see the overlap that is there. It's difficult for us to see the overlap. It's difficult for anyone, I think, to see the overlap that's there. That's one thing that's good about the Book of Psalms, is that David repeatedly reminds us that the overlap is total. And, you know, given that inspiration, we need to go out there and look for it. Look for it hard enough, you'll find it. Well, what we've been looking at the last couple of weeks, you know, those are the positive evidences, but some of those positive evidences are being swept aside because some of the negative science apologetics that's rife within Christianity. And so we're going to take our time to look at that as we go through the chapters of Genesis, because that's where a lot of this stuff happens. And the problem here is that you get people being exposed to what I was been sharing here about Genesis and saying, well, now, wait a minute. Okay, you got these 14 events, these four initial conditions, and they're all correctly described and correctly sequenced. But none of that matters if the text teaches me that the universe was created in 4004 BC. If that's the case, I chuck the whole thing. And, you know, this is what actually Moses exhorts us to do within Deuteronomy. He says, you know, the prophet is a false prophet if you can demonstrate one provable error. If it's from God, it's 100%. It's not just 90%, it's 100%. And this is how you can spot the true prophets from the false prophets. And so these issues we need to deal with. You know, because sometimes I run into people who say, let's not worry about that issue. Let's just look at what we have here. The problem is a non-Christian is worried about this issue, and you're not going to get them to forget it. Likewise, looking at carnivorous activity, looking at the flood. And so we need to deal with these issues. But as I was sharing last week, often what's occurring here is that people within the church have some fears about what really dealing with these doctrines is going to mean for them, for their Christian life, and for the life of their church, their fellowships. And so they have these skillful ways of protecting their fears with doctrinal smokescreens. And I read you an example. It was just published 2 weeks ago. Last week, I read you a portion. I'm going to read you a second portion, a much briefer one. That thing took a long time to read last week. I didn't think it would take me that long. I guess I got to learn to talk faster. So I'm going to take some more lessons from Robbie Zacharias, right? or our kids. I mean, I don't know. I sit at the dinner table trying to get a word in edgewise, and it just doesn't happen.
You're like, how about those engines?
Yeah, my boys didn't get my genes, so. all right. Hey, Kathy. I'm not blaming it on you, dear.
It's the grandparents.
The first time I was introduced to Kathy's family, she brought me over to spend a meal with her family. And after it was all over, she says, you never talked. I was waiting to get a word in edgewise. Nobody ever stopped. Nobody ever breathed. And what I found out is that Kathy is a quiet one in her family.
You and Tom really do have something.
Sure. Well, I learned to be more aggressive, and this class has taught me some things about that, too. So it's been helpful. So I think it's not just the genetics. It's the California culture, too. That's part of it. So.
Way to go, dude.
All right. Get on with the lesson, right?
Oh, it's gonna be cold night tonight.
Yeah. My notes.
One note.
Okay.
It's like this every Sunday, folks.
Tell people I'm playing those little cards all over the house.
Oh.
I dare not throw them away because they're huge notes.
You know how it is, you sit on airplanes and you got these things you can pull out and you can write, and I don't know, aircraft travel's gotten different. I mean, now you're cramped up and so enough about that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So okay. I read this piece last week on Old Earth Creationism from Henry Morris, and we got through the thing and made up a nice long list, but Tom assured me he had much more stuff on his list. So I'm going to give you a chance just to... what we were doing, by the way, is I read this piece, and what I did with the class here is I said, look, don't listen to the doctrines. You know, try to shut that out and see if you can discern the fears that are underlying the expressions of doctrinal alarm. And I think that's a key point, that word alarm, is that people bring up these doctrinal issues as if they're sounding an alarm here. We got a problem here. We need to stop this. And really what they're doing is they're diverting people onto this ringing of the alarm that we got a doctrinal problem here. And it's threatening to destroy the church, and we need to get on and emphasize that doctrine, when in fact there's a fear underlying that's being ignored. And what we, the point we made 2 weeks ago is that so often what you see within church history is that the really important doctrinal issues don't get dealt with. The church sleeps on the really significant doctrinal issues, but they get all emotionally riled over the doctrinal issues that have no bearing on the Christian faith. And this is a key example. He's bringing up doctrinal issues that have no bearing on the Christian faith, no significant bearing on biblical inerrancy or the Christian faith. And you see this tremendous sound of alarm, and yet the church is quietly ignoring issues that really do threaten the basics of the Christian faith, and how that's been true throughout 2,000 years of church history. And it's something you see in the New Testament, that in the New Testament we have Paul having to deal with an issue that really has no bearing on the Christian faith. If you want to become a Christian, you got to get circumcised. And circumcision's got nothing to do with the Christian faith. And yet, side by side with that, we have the church ignoring the problem of the Gnostic heresy. And so Paul has to wake up to the church. Hey, we got a really serious doctrinal problem here that we're not dealing with. And nobody's getting emotionally excited about it. And yet we got this other issue here, which is completely insignificant, and everybody's all involved in that. That's splitting the church. This other thing is not splitting the church. It's something that we should be dealing with. He says, you know, literally, kick these people out. They don't belong here. They're promoting false teaching. And he says, other problem, don't worry about it. It's not significant. And really, you can read every century of church history, and you see that's been the case. That's what Paul warns us about. He says, you know, Satan's not dumb. He spends much more time inside the church and outside the church because he can, you know, get people riled up on the wrong reasons and not riled up for the right reasons. It will be a very effective tool for discouraging people from listening to the evidences for the Christian faith. So it's no different today. And it's going to be no different 10 years from now. These two issues we're going to talk about, I'm convinced 10 years from now, people say, gee, were we ever concerned about that? And, you know, we'll be dealing with different things. Different things will be here. So what I'm trying to do here in the class is to develop tools for dealing with these things in general, not specifically. So I think too often the church goes after the specific issue, then when something new comes along, they got to start from ground zero. We can use the same methods, the same tools for dealing with each problem that comes up. I think if we take that perspective, these issues will do a lot less damage to the church rather than the damage has been so typical. And also realize that even when you solve these problems, the emotions will take a long time to heal. If you look at the Galileo issue, it took 300 years for the emotions to calm down. So I don't think it's going to be that long with these issues, but don't expect it to go away in 1 week. So something the pastor was talking about today. It takes time. So I'm going to let those who were not able to make their comments last week to make their comments. Then we'll give you example number two, and then we're going to go into the steps for resolution. Okay? Now maybe you've forgotten everything, in which case I can just jump right into Jump into it? Okay. All right. This one's from Henry's son, John. And it's much shorter, so we'll get through it fast. And the title is this. If all animals were created as plant eaters, why do some have sharp teeth? Okay. And you can already hear the emotional edge here. It's really not good for God to create animal with sharp teeth because those sharp teeth are going to be used to rip, tear, and shred. The issue of nature, red in tooth and claw. Okay, you probably heard that phrase before. This goes back about 100 years. Anyway, I'll just read this. And again, don't listen to the doctrinal smokescreen. See if you can discern what it is that these people raising this issue are really afraid of. What are their fears? Fears in terms of the church, what it says about God, etc. Here goes. The Bible specifically teaches that in the original very good Genesis 1:31 earth, all of the animals were to be plant eaters. Verse 30. It wasn't until after Adam sinned and the curse of death was pronounced on all creation, Genesis 3:14-19, that things began to die. How is it then that so many animals seem fully designed to be meat eaters? Some produce deadly poisons, others have armored plates as elaborate defense mechanisms. If animals were created to live in harmony, what was the purpose? Unfortunately, God doesn't give us all the details. All we can do is begin with what we do know and make reasonable inferences. I can think of several possibilities which are biblically acceptable, but it may be that a combination of these or some other best reflects the truth. The first is that God in his foreknowledge knew that soon things would change, and so he created animals with features they would need in the new economy. Or it may be that these features had some other more benign function originally. The second option is a great deal more potential for variation was placed in the original genome. At first, the animals were designed to live a herbivore's lifestyle, but adopted new habits in the more harsh world following the curse. Today, following many generations of variation, adaptation, and selection, animal groups have speciated so much that extensive variation is impossible. Or it may be that something more sinister was involved. Remember the overall scenario? Lucifer, the highest in God's angelic hierarchy, had been defeated and cast out of heaven. His arrogant pride had been wounded. In his rage, he may have set out to ruin God's beautiful creation, first recruiting Adam and Eve to follow him, and then after the curse, proceeded to so distort the image of God and man that the perfect seed of the woman could not follow. Is it possible this highly intelligent being performed breeding experiments or genetic engineering on both mankind and the animals? Genesis 6:2-4. In his attempt to mock the true Creator God and usurp his authority, perhaps even the ancient legends of composite mixtures of beasts and half men and half beasts have some basis in fact. My preferred speculation follows. The Genesis 3 account of the curse speaks of the great changes which would follow. Each one requires a genetic change. Plants would grow thorns and thistles. The serpent would slither on his belly, cursed along with the rest of the animals. Eve's body would be changed, making childbirth a laborious experience. Each of these changes requires a DNA alteration, and now instead of being very good, the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain. Romans 8:22, due to the presence of sin and its penalty, death. I suspect that in his infinite wisdom, God completely changed creation, with all things dying, some animals quite vicious, from then on giving eloquent testimony to the awful consequences of sin. From then on, whenever Adam saw one of the animals kill another, he would have experienced remorse for what he had brought on creation. And today, as we see the same thing, it should drive us back to our Creator's gracious provision for sin and to expectantly look forward to the time when there shall be no more death. Okay? So the issue is plain. He's saying, you know, based on doctrine, there could have been no animals or plants dying before Adam and Eve sinned, and there could be no animals eating other animals. That didn't happen. And so he goes on to speculate as to what God did. But what are the fears? Why are people raising these doctrinal issues? Yes. Very good. Excellent. Okay, did you all hear that? Okay, a little louder.
If God might not be good, wise, and merciful, or else maybe that Satan is with
him. Okay. All right. Well, this piece came out before that went to press. Yeah. I'm very curious what they're going to say about the cloning thing. So, right. A lot of Christians were. You're right. Okay. Some other fears. Yes.
The devil might be more powerful than we thought previously. God might not be as powerful.
Yeah, notice the attribution to Satan of the capacity to do all this genetic engineering.
Yes.
Okay? So yeah, that's a fear there, that Satan may be a lot more powerful and God a little weaker than what we may be thinking. And that's a scary thing to think about. Okay?
His mention of adaptation and that occurring and different things changing, is tied to Satan, not to God.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like he is stating that evolution did happen.
That evolution happened really big time.
Big time, and in a very short time frame.
Yeah. Yeah, and Ralph can explain to us, I mean, what it would take for an animal that's been designed to be a herbivore with four stomachs to rapidly evolve in a matter of weeks into a creature with big teeth and now designed with the capacity to just eat meat. You know, you're not just talking evolving claws and teeth. You have to change the whole internal organ system so this creature can go from one diet to another diet. And never mind the fact that they got to be able to run a little faster and, you know, you got to catch these things. So there's a hand over here. Okay. No? Yes.
I think he had a tremendous fear that if there was any death prior to the sin of Adam and Eve, that there is, there also be no redemption because death is endemic to all creating things, and Adam and Eve, human death is part and parcel of all the other deaths. here, for death would not be the result of sin, and therefore, if this was what he was, then there's no possibility of it ever being restored or what it should be.
Well, that's the greatest fear that they express in the rest of their literature. That if we give any room for death before the fall, then that destroys the doctrine of redemption. And so there's this tying of physical death into the idea that of Christ's death on the cross. I mean, I don't know what it said. Yes, we read this last week, how Henry closed off his comments by saying, you know, if any of this stuff is true that old earth creationism is telling us, then Christ's death on the cross is meaningless. You know, and you say, where did that come from? Well, it's this idea that if there's any death at all before Adam's sin in the Garden of Eden, that would somehow destroy the possibility of Christ dying and redeeming us from our sins. So, yeah, that's a big fear. Yes?
Death before the fall, when you said that, immediately made me think what their attitude is. The animals being short of spiritual creatures as we are. What does the redemption have to do? And therefore death, what does that have to do with redemption if those creatures don't need redemption?
Right. Yeah, no, that you're getting on to how do we resolve it. And, you know, that's really good. That's it. That is how you resolve it, is that Scripture makes the point that it's humanity that is redeemed. The grass doesn't have to be redeemed. Okay.
There's a fear that we talked about in another article last year, that fear that maybe nature is a revelation of God, not in addition to the Bible. And there seems to be this
That they're partially ignorant. Exactly. All of us human beings struggle with that, don't we? We really want to know everything. And we get a little bit upset that God hasn't told us everything. But yet part and parcel of this movement is this idea we simply study the Bible enough, we can learn everything we need to know. We don't have to look outside the Bible. And yet there's this fear being expressed that people might pay too much attention to the record of nature. What's going to happen if people read that too much and don't read the Bible enough? They'll be led astray. So there is that fear. Yeah, Ted, and then I'll come back to you, Kathy.
I just had a quick comment about Satan. You've got to remember that ascribing to him powers to do what was said in that article does not demean God in any way. But you got to remember that Satan challenged God. Now, he wasn't going to do that if he didn't think that he had the power to win. So when God cast him out, he didn't take those powers away from him. He just restricted it. So the people who think that Satan is this guy and a tail and horns and all that, they're missing the point and they're playing right into his hands. Satan is a very, very powerful being. And God did not restrict him as much as we like to think he did.
Some of us, I'd like to suggest there are two problems. One problem in the church is that we don't give Satan enough credit. Another problem in the church is we give him too much credit. And Satan has a good time either way. Okay? So, and, you know, I think what's interesting about your point is that one of the deceptions of evil is that we think we can win where we can't. Okay? I mean, those of us that are parents, we see it when kids are really little. You know, they think they can pull it off. And they rebel against us, thinking they can do it better than we can, when we kind of laugh at it and say, you know, they don't even have the physical capacities to carry out what they're planning to do. And as they get older, that, you know, becomes less and less a case. They wake up to reality. He thought he was powerful enough to challenge God himself.
And he brought enough of the angels with him. Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people that think he's powerful enough. So,
The yeah. point, I think, is that that man is not that far off in allowing the possibility that Satan bioengineered things up there. That does not lower God in my estimation. As a matter of fact, it raises him up and says, hey, he did wipe Satan out and try to destroy evil by destroying him.
But that would make Satan a real
man. Yeah. Yeah, there's some doctrine.
That reason alone, I think we should know as much about
sure.
as possible.
No, I agree, but then you're not suffering from the fear that they might not agree. Okay? I think that's what's really going on in both of these pieces. There's underlying fear that, gee, maybe the record of nature isn't going to agree with my understanding of the words of the Bible. And they could just say it that way, could deliver them from the fear. But the problem is they don't see it as their understanding of the Bible, rather they see it as the Bible itself. And therefore, there's this tremendous fear that the Bible might not stand up. And so, I'm not even going to look at it. I don't want to see it. God said it, that settles it. You know, you ever seen those bumper stickers? Yeah, it makes me upset when I see those bumper stickers. Yeah, go ahead. True. Yeah, the Bible tells us we should fear spiritual death more than physical death, but don't all of us have the tendency to be much more concerned about physical death? We pay a lot more money to try to put off physical death than we do to deal with the spiritual death. So, yeah, Don.
While you're stripping things down and getting to the roots of things, I think there's some evidence just this morning. I'd like to talk a little bit about the ego of the animals. Now, animals particularly have big egos, and Ralph has mentioned to us already that one of the beautiful things about your scientific meeting was that they didn't let their egos get in the way of discussion and progress. And here, another problem with us analysts is that we don't talk like that. And so we tend to think we're getting left behind in the conversation. Now, when you get a guy with an article like this, many times I believe people defend their article because their ego is bound up in it. You know, and just as Proverbs says, if you rebuke a wise man, he'll become wiser still. But if you rebuke a fool, he'll turn and mend you. So analysts have a tendency, if they say it, then they've got to defend it. And rather than saying, here's just one attempt at it, and now help me to learn more, we tend, and I think that's where some of the younger guys are. Having said it, they're afraid to admit they're wrong.
Yeah.
So there's a huge investment on their part to prove that what they're saying is correct.
Yeah.
By creating a whole new science in essence.
Like, I'm not worthy as a person unless this is the right theory.
Well, I can remember a professor I had in my younger years, and he made this point to us graduate students. Says, when you start writing research papers, what I want you to do in the opening paragraph of your paper is make it very clear that this is simply an attempt to understand. And that you want the readers to help you deal with your lack of understanding. Because if you start off your research paper with that note of humility, it's going to make it a lot easier for you to back away when it's proven that you're wrong. Yeah. And he says, 90% of the time, that will happen. That's how science progresses.
Show me where this is wrong. Let's get closer to the truth. Mm-hmm. Not, this is the truth. I'll defend it to the death. But here's an idea. Here's an approach. Let's examine. Let's see if it's true. Where it's wrong, let's get closer to the truth.
Well, yeah. Several of our graduate students, what we did is we come up with a better phrase. It's like, you know, dear reader, in looking at my paper here, I hope you can find me wrong here. Because if you can find me wrong here, then we can make some real scientific progress. But if we don't find what's wrong here, we're not going to make any progress. And that's a real good guard of keeping your ego out of it. And you put it in print. So, I mean, if you are proven wrong, you really are committed to back down. You got to be trained to do that, and it's not easy to put that in our research papers. So, but it's good for us. Yeah, Tony.
In fact, that actual attitude is encouraged in Scripture.
So
to keep our teachers aligned.
Yeah. Yeah, share good things with your teachers. And what it means is share all the ways he blows it, okay? So, But yeah, and the other side too, and be sure to point out that, which is good. Yeah, Marge.
I agree with that, but I think that really the biggest fear that they built their entire lives on a lie. And the fear that, plus they said that if this is true, if this doesn't prove false, then that wipes out the entire doctrine of redemption. So there's the fear that if they're proven wrong, then that means the Bible goes.
Yeah.
That's a fear we each one have.
Yeah.
What if Christianity isn't the religion?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's the same fear we all have.
Yeah, we have that fear, but I think what would be healthy is to say, look, I got a fear this might not be right. But that fear is going to help me learn things about the Christian faith I don't know today. So let's exploit that fear.
Yep.
But what we're seeing here is let's run away from the fear. So that's build walls around it.
That has a lot to do with the personality style. It could be that the people in ICR are very closure oriented. The Myers-Briggs classification has the union four functions, but allied to that is extroversion, introversion, closure. So they call that judgment. And being open, being able to let things hang for a while. Without reaching the conclusion, those are called perceiving people. I think it's a misnomer, but I think I know where it comes from. And you might have people in ICR that are very closure-oriented. They're sticking to their guns. They want closure, and they can't live with things just hanging for a while.
Yeah. No loose ends. That's a very good insight. Go ahead.
I'm sure that I can make this fit and rationalize and figure it out so it works. So I want to be in control to make sure that happens. And I can trust God.
Okay, a fear of lack of control. That's really good. So otherwise, over here, Glenn Ellen.
I just thought one of the things about the fellow who worked on the string theory for Santa Barbara was that he was one of the only ones who was really willing, because he was young, because he didn't have as much of a reputation to lose, he really stuck his neck out and they were all congratulating on how brave he was, to think backwards from the final goal through these crazy steps so that he could come up with this integrated theory of physics. And he was saying that you have to understand that our grants for a very livelihood depend upon our being right, and therefore we all pick things that we know are provable or have already been proved, so that we can continue to tell people, see, we're doing the right thing. Because he says, if we're totally wrong, our livelihood in these grants goes down the drain, so there's a lot to lose in science with some of these things being wrong. Even if we are very creative and extremely intelligent, if we don't come to the conclusion that is in the mainstream, ostracized.
Okay, there's a fear that your financial resources might dry up. Do you think that ever happens in Christian nonprofit organizations? That people are afraid their finances might dry up? So. Ah, yes, thanks.
On the center of God's attention and focus, because the Bible tells us there was a problem for them. Talked about Satan was cast out, and if we look at spiritual death, being separation from God, God isn't created the bottomless pit and all of that for our, because of us, it's the punishment of Satan. And so a lot of the resolution of good and evil isn't necessarily, it's the resolution of good and evil that Satan is.
Okay, very good. I'm glad you brought that up before the class ended. There's an ego issue here. And you know, that's what hit me first when I read this thing. Who's to say that we're so important that we're the ones that are completely responsible for all this death and carnivorous activity of plants, animals, etc.? Who are we to elevate ourselves to that point, to say that we're the ones that did it all? And that somehow we're so significant here that God can't overrule that. And therefore, it was our sin that caused all this destruction we see around us. We are the ones that are responsible But in one sense, it's an ego trip. And what's underlying this is the fear that maybe we're not all that significant. Maybe God had some other purposes in line. Maybe there's something else going on. Maybe we're just part of something that's much bigger. And that takes a little bit of humility to accept. So that's very quick comment, then we're going to pray because we're over time.
I have a historical background in history, my major in college. And when I started examining evolution and issues, I came from a historical point of view. What happened, happened. What happened in history has happened. And I can discover what has happened, but I can't change what happened. And I think it's really important to come back to what happened, happened. And we uncover it, we may only see partially what has happened or not see totally clearly what has happened in the past, but we can't alter what has happened. It has happened, and we argue about it, but it won't change it. And therefore, let's not be afraid about what has happened. What has happened. God indeed has created the world. We will see evidence of that in historical evidence. If he didn't create it all, then he didn't, but whatever. It has already happened.
Yep, it's hard to argue against the law of gravity. Okay, it keeps hitting you in the face. So, and you may not like it, you may not agree with it, but it's not going to make much difference. Okay, Father in heaven, I pray you would help us in going through these studies to squarely face the reality of what you revealed to us in the record of nature and your words of the Bible. Deliver us from the egotism that would say that our interpretation must be right. Everyone else's interpretation must be wrong. I pray you give us the willingness to face possibilities that we might need to adjust our understanding of the text. And this is going to be a lifelong experience for us. We're never going to have everything buttoned down. And Lord, I pray that you would give us a compassion for the fears that are there, to admit that there are still fears within us on all these issues. Help us to identify those fears in one another and not to look down our noses in people that are suffering from different fears than we're suffering from. So give us a spirit of compassion, and I pray you would equip us with the tools that are necessary to dig into these fears and to explore them and to deal with them in a way that brings ultimate healing and resolution. In a manner, too, Father, that will equip us to deal with future problems that you will bless us with. And thank you for blessing us with these crises and problems, for the growth it brings about in us, in our character, in our spirit. In Jesus' name, amen.